Job openings galore, auto loans booming, signs of life in the economy at last. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, September 7th. Glad you could be with us. Today's show is all about taking the good with the bad. This morning, we got a new report. It's called the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. This data covers July, and it showed a record number of job openings. People feeling confident that they can quit their old jobs and feel pretty sure about getting a new one. So that's all good news, right? Yep, right until you open your paycheck. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
We now see more job openings, 5.9 million in the economy, than ever before. More people are quitting for new jobs, a sign of optimism. And in some fields, employers need a lot of workers, says Andrew Chamberlain at the job site Glassdoor.
You see many open positions in healthcare, professional and business services, and some leisure and hospitality.
Chamberlain says in hot fields, paychecks are rising 6 to 12% a year. But across the whole economy, average wages are only rising about 2.5%, meaning employers still mostly don't feel compelled to offer higher pay to fill positions. So there are several explanations in the let's make a wage deal game. Behind door number one, the economy's really not that great, says Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
So many people have left the labor market, prime age workers, 25 to 54-year-olds. So that suggests that there's a lot of people who might, in principle, want to work.
Behind door number two, employers actually aren't trying that hard. Here's economist Jesse Rothstein at UC Berkeley.
Increasingly, employers are announcing job openings at a maybe less than competitive wage, leaving it open for months to see if somebody great comes along.
And door number three, employers are using lures other than pay to get good people, says Lori Farley-Toth at HR recruiting firm ADECO.
Not just from a compensatory place, meaning just a salary, but what are the benefits, right?
For millennial workers, the prize may be more flexibility and opportunity rather than another 2% in their paycheck. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
More almost good news. The Credit Bureau Experian says loans for new and used cars are at their highest levels on record. There's over $1 trillion in loans out there, which is potentially another sign of confidence in the American economy. Although the automotive lending industry has gotten a lot of scrutiny in recent years, there are concerns over predatory lending, especially in the subprime part of the market. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Experian's report suggests we shouldn't worry too much about a subprime bubble in auto lending. Melinda Zabritsky is senior director of automotive finance at Experian. She says, sure, there is an increase in subprime loans, but she notes all types of loans are up, and subprime share of the overall pie is actually down.
So when you look at the entire market, loans and leases combined, the market is very, very prime.
And while delinquencies were up slightly over the year, Zabritsky says that's also not a big red flag.
We're still at very low historical levels of delinquency.
Still, Chris Kukla at the Center for Responsible Lending worries about what's yet to come. He notes that the average term on new car loans is 68 months, which he says is up from more like 62 months a few years ago. Kukla says interest rates on deep subprime loans can sometimes run above 20%, and some borrowers might end up owing more than their cars are worth.
You put all of those things together, and that's a recipe for folks not being able to repay their car loans. And it means that eventually the number of people who start losing their cars could significantly increase.
Jenna Grodecki in Kalamazoo, Michigan, isn't crazy about the financing terms she got this past April when she bought a 2013 Ford Fusion. She's 25 and has a lot of student loans. She's not a subprime borrower, but did get a really long term for her car loan, more than 6 years.
But at this point in time, it was the only option that I had.
Grodecki's just hoping she'll eventually earn more and can pay it off faster. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, NASDAQ still soaring, even Apple up a bit. You'll see why that's a surprise in a minute. The rest of the market, not so much. We'll have the rest of the details when we do the numbers. Apple held its now annual iPhone announcement event in San Francisco this morning. The company unveiled the iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus, and Apple is under some pressure to make a splash with the new phone. The iPhone is its primary source of revenue, and it's seen two straight quarters of profit declines. It is getting harder to sell smartphones out there. And these new devices are missing a crucial component, the good old headphone jack. Rumors of its disappearance before the official announcement had a lot of consumers, including me, in a rage. So how are they responding today? Joanna Stern is personal technology columnist with The Wall Street Journal. I caught up with her earlier from the event. Hey, Joanna, how are you?
Good.
All right, Joanna, let's talk about the headphone jack. Its removal was the big rumor before the show. What happened and what's the response?
So all rumors turned out to be true, as has been the history recently with Apple. No headphone jack on the new iPhone 7 or the 7 Plus. That means you will plug in headphones into the lightning cable where you've typically charged the phone. So to ease this transition for customers, what they've done is they've put earbuds in the box that plug into the lightning port. They've also included a dongle, which lets you plug into the lightning port and then plug in your old headphones into the opposite end of that dongle. So Apple definitely trying to ease the pain for customers, but it's a big move. It's definitely a big move.
So what's the kind of economic impact of a move like that? I would imagine it opens up a whole universe of accessories to be sold, right?
It definitely does, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Apple's also marketing its new AirPods. So Apple says that they think the real solution here ends up being that wireless is going to replace the cords that we've used to listen to our music. So they are going to be selling what they call AirPods. They're about $150 or $160, and they have no wires. So it's like an old-fashioned Bluetooth headset. You put one in one ear, you put the other in the other ear. No cord even connects them both.
All right, Joanna, I want to play this clip for you. This is Apple Senior Vice President Phil Schiller talking about why Apple removed the headphone jack.
Well, the reason to move on, I'm going to give you three of them, but it really comes down to one word, courage. The courage to move on, do something new that betters all of us. And our team has tremendous courage.
Yeah, finally had some courage. There's a lot of places where, a lot of situations where this is actually going to be a really big inconvenience. I mean, for me specifically, flying on airplanes, I mean, I got my lightning headphones. Now, what if I want to plug into the seat in front of me and watch a movie? What am I supposed to do?
Or charge the phone.
Or charge the phone.
So let's talk about the smartphone market overall. This new phone is launched in a market that has seen a steep decline in interest from people upgrading to new phones. There's speculation that we may be at peak smartphone in terms of features. What do you think? How many more times can people be convinced to upgrade their flagship smartphone?
I have said that I think we've hit peak smartphone. That is in the sense that we are waiting for some of the core features to get better, but overall most people are really satisfied with their phones. I think it's these incremental updates to the things that bother us the most that are going to really change how we go forward.
Any other highlights from the event today?
I think the Apple Watch is interesting. They didn't spend as much time talking about the Apple Watch as they did the iPhone, but certainly it's an important product for Apple. It's going to be waterproof, so you can swim with it. That's really big for swimmers. They've got GPS in it, which is really big for runners and bikers. So I think it's an interesting update. It'll still be $350 around, and the first generation will be dropped down. So maybe that also fuels more people to buy it.
Cheaper is usually better. That's Joanna Stern, personal tech columnist at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for your time.
Great to speak to you.
I'd like to stay here in nerd territory for a little while because that is just how I roll. If you were stranded in a remote sector of the Delta Quadrant, You might have missed the fact that tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. The original NBC series made it so on September 8th, 1966. We are commemorating it in the most marketplace way we can think of by interviewing economist Paul Krugman. He's a Nobel laureate, a columnist at the New York Times, and a really big sci-fi fan. Of course, that includes Star Trek, which, as it turns out, has some fascinating economic aspects. Professor Krugman, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So obviously with the Star Trek anniversary upcoming, I want to start there. What is it about Star Trek? You've been on panels talking about this in the past, that jumps out at you economically.
Yeah, we had this – actually, we had a great panel at Comic-Con, New York Comic-Con last year, with based around a book by Manu Saadia, who's written a book called Trekonomics, which is – you know, he wrote the book on this subject. Mm-hmm. And the point that he centers around is that – not in the original series, but thereafter in the Star Trek universe, it's a world of total abundance. It's a world where replicators will make anything you want. So it's a world that has no money. It's not a world where anybody asks, can I afford this? It's not a world in which people work for the sake of getting rich. And that's interesting. That's very different.
What economic disparity or what sort of dark side could be lurking? Because you don't think post-scarcity is the only thing at play in the Star Trek universe, right?
Right. Well, first of all, it turns out that there's lots of room for things to go wrong. There's lots of room for evil. Do we have examples of post-scarcity, you know, economies in miniature out there? And we do in various versions. Some of us live, actually college professors live in an environment where there isn't that much disparity in salaries, but there's lots of disparity in prestige and how you're regarded. People still compete over certain jobs. Is that really the end of the problem? And in the Star Trek universe, there's violence, there's war, there's an amazing number of holodeck malfunctions. But anyway, leaving that aside. And so the question is, even if we could get past, you know, maybe money is not the root of all evil is one of the lessons I think of Star Trek, kind of an unintended one.
What do you think Star Trek gets right when it comes to imagining our economic future?
I believe that the notion that it's not going to be the same. That I have to say one failing of a lot of speculative fiction, science fiction, whatever, about the future is it often tends to imagine that it's actually very old fashioned. That it's still brawny workers and cruel bosses. And if you like a contrast, I like Star Wars too. But the Star Wars universe seems to be one where they have all this technology and all these robots, and yet the structure of the human economy with slaves and all of that seems to be almost medieval. Is that's really not very likely? That's not how it's going to be. So Star Trek, by saying, look, it can be different, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And last question, I feel like there's a lot more material now on television. I'm thinking of shows like The Expanse or Killjoys on Sci-Fi that are starting to look at the sort of more of the 99%, if you will, the dispossessed. Which seems to really stand in contrast to Star Trek. Do you think it was just a sort of an outdated mode of storytelling?
No, I think it's just that we actually have a I think we're looking in some ways at the change in the political environment. You know, Star Trek, certainly the original series was at the height of optimism about the welfare state. It was the war on poverty. Wouldn't have envisioned a future. You know, it's the 1960s. You wouldn't have thought, well, the future is one of there's no jobs for workers and there's an enormously wealthy elite. That was stuff that was the past. That was the Gilded Age. That wasn't going to happen again. Now we're living in the second Gilded Age, which in many ways is more gilded than the first. And so it makes sense that our vision of the future, your vision of the future always reflects the present. And right now, oligarchy seems like a fairly natural state for humanity.
Professor Paul Krugman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up.
And they're ending up then in jails, which is not appropriate.
People with mental illness falling through the cracks. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped less than a tenth percent, about 11 points, to close at 18,526. The S&P 500 was flat. It ended right where it began at 2186, but the NASDAQ logged another record high. It gained a tenth percent, 8 points, to finish at 5283. Speaking of being up high, nothing could slow down airline stocks today. They soared after a series of positive comments by industry executives. Delta shares were up more than 5% on expectations of fuller planes and, yep, higher tickets. Prices. That helped boost American Airlines, which added more than 4.75%. Ditto for United, Continental, and Southwest, flew more than 4.5% higher. We told you about the new Apple iPhone 7. Well, the Apple Watch also got an upgrade, and investors seemed good with all the changes. Apple stock up more than 0.6%. And the real winner in all the Apple news, Nintendo. Bonds held steady, though. The yield on the 10-year T-note remained at 1.53%, and you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Here's a story about a company with a really good problem. The Danish company Lego, the world's most profitable toy maker. Business has been so good in recent years that Lego can't keep up with demand, and so it is actually trying to reduce that demand. It scaled back on advertising last year, hoping to slow sales, and buy time to ramp up production. As Marketplace's Adam Allington reports in the Here Today, Gone Tomorrow market that is usually children's toys, Legos are the exception to the rule.
This is the sound of two generations of Legos being poured onto the floor, mine and my son's. As a parent, I know two things. One, they hurt like heck when you accidentally step on them in the middle of the night. And two, kids just can't get enough of them. So is it odd that Lego would try to put the brakes on all that momentum?
Not necessarily odd, but I think it's very representative of the evolution of a large corporation.
Stephanie Wissink is a toy industry analyst at Piper Jaffray. A little over a decade ago, Lego was contracting. Now they can't meet global demand, primarily thanks to a series of savvy branding partnerships.
Things like Star Wars or Minecraft, Marvel, partnerships they have with large media companies where they're able to piggyback.
That helped drive revenue increases of 15% per year for the past 12 years. The company says it now needs to invest in some breathing space. In the toy sector, that kind of sustained growth is just unheard of, says BMO analyst Garrick Johnson.
They sell a plastic brick. There's no patent protection on this brick. Anyone can make this brick, yet they've been able to grow demand for that long, and it's a tribute for their innovation.
Normally, Johnson says, kids grow up, toys fall out of fashion, but Lego has kept its appeal. Shoot, how many adults do you know who still collect Legos? So, prospects for a fall back to earth?
I'm not sure you're going to see a sales collapse with Lego.
The company is in the process of building its first factory in China and has added 3,500 new jobs worldwide. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A huge number of people in jails and prisons in the U.S. have some sort of disability. In fact, that number is anywhere between 30 and 50%, depending on how you count it, mostly mental or cognitive disabilities. Advocates say jailing people is an expensive and ineffective way to treat behavioral health. Marketplace's Lewis Wallace has a look at one story that ended in tragedy.
All his life, Kevin Matthews loved gifts. Not getting them, giving them.
My birthday, Mother's Day, Christmas was very, very special to him.
This is his mom, Valerie Johnson. One year for her birthday, Kevin got her a pair of pink running shoes, pink leggings, and a pink crown to wear to the party.
And I said, I'm not going to wear that for my birthday. He said, that's what I bought it for, you to wear for your birthday. So I put it on, and boy, it made him so happy. He had the biggest smile on his face.
Kevin lived with his mom on the northwest edge of Detroit. When he was 11, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. This is his older sister, Kim Matthews.
From the day he was born, as he started growing up and we saw something was wrong, we extra loved him hard. We gave him extra attention, extra love.
As an adult, she says he liked to wander the streets, talking to people. And that's how police usually came into contact with him.
It was mainly because of his illness that he did get in trouble here and there.
He went to jail a few times, small stuff related to alcohol, a couple dropped charges. She says he wasn't worried about time in jail.
He'd be like, oh, it's okay, you know, I'm going to be all right. I met these people. They're really nice.
But his family always worried something would happen. Even at age 35, he was vulnerable, easy to take advantage of. And then something did happen. Last December, his mom was waiting for him to come home around noon. She called Kevin's girlfriend, who was just around the corner.
I said, what you doing around the corner? She says, it's a guy around here just got killed. And then I felt it.
Valerie Johnson's gut feeling was right. Just around the corner on the border of Detroit and the suburb of Dearborn, her son was laying out on the street. Kevin Matthews had been shot at least 6 times by a Dearborn police officer. The family says they stood behind a police barricade all day, but nobody talked to them. They still hardly know anything about what happened. In a press release later, police said they were pursuing Kevin on a suspected larceny. After a struggle of some kind, police said an officer, still unnamed, discharged his weapon, and they said Kevin was unarmed. Ron Haddad, the Dearborn police chief, added in an interview that officers in his department knew Kevin. They knew his face and where he lived.
I am very confident that not only him, but most people we come in contact with, we treat in a very civil manner, but particularly Kevin Matthews. He was treated very civilly on more than one occasion by members of our department.
Sometimes Kevin would do things like go to sleep on the street. Haddad says at least once officers gave him a ride home. He calls Kevin's death regrettable, especially since the department has been working on de-escalation.
I'm very proud of what we've done here over the last 8 years because our use of force has dropped down over 90%.
Haddad says the majority of people his department sees are either mentally disabled or dealing with a substance problem. Kevin's family says he was usually on medication, but when he had an episode, there was nowhere to go, no one to call. And that's common, partly because of long-term cuts to behavioral health services around the country. Michigan alone cut tens of millions from mental health from 2009 to 2012.
The shortage in the clinicians, as well as the cuts in funding, result in really, really high caseloads.
Carmen McIntyre is with the Detroit Wayne County Mental Health Authority. She says wait times can be long, say if you just want to talk to a therapist. So it's easy for people like Kevin to fall through the cracks.
And they're ending up then in jails, which is not appropriate.
Right now, it's impossible to track just how many victims of police violence are disabled. But Lawrence Carter Long, a disability activist, co-authored a study of media reports and estimated the number is between a half and two-thirds. He says disability itself is being criminalized.
If you tell a person who's autistic to freeze or stop, and maybe they're overstimulated at that moment, you're basically asking them to not be autistic. You're asking them not to be disabled, which is really impossible.
Kevin Matthews' relatives have organized several protests. His mom has been too overwhelmed to work, and Kim says she cries every day. But it's his little brother, Lavelle, who is the shakiest.
He was the middle sibling. He kept us together because we all felt like we had a job to do, which was keep him close, keep him grounded.
Lavelle says he's had a hard time in the past, but for the last 5 years, he's had a steady job, tried to be a good parent to his twin kids, motivated by the fact that Kevin saw him, his younger brother, as a role model.
Everything I stood for, everything I was living for, everything that I've been working so hard for to show him and be a better example to him because he looked up to me, is lost. And I can't get it back.
Kevin Matthews' death is under investigation by the Wayne County prosecutor. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, many of us were saddened when the beer brand Dos Equis sent its classic character, the most interesting man in the world, off on a rocket ship to Mars.
I don't always drink beer, but when I do,
I prefer Dos Equis.
I miss him. The company, though, said it needed something different. Someone who could appeal to a younger, more multicultural drinking audience. Well, today, Dos Equis unveiled the new most interesting man in the world. See if you can spot the most obvious difference.
No es fácil saberlo.
If you would like to get a look at the new guy, we've got a link to the trailer the company put out today over at our website, marketplace.org. They tell me it is time to go. The Dow and the S&P 500 didn't do a lot today. Dow dipped less than a 10%, S&P 500 flat. But the NASDAQ logged another record high, gaining a 0.1%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.